You're listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk. Number 527.
Hello and welcome back once again to the Outdoor Station and the second part of my in-depth interview with Bethany Fidget Hughes and Lauren Neon Reed. Two ladies who set out 5 years ago to traverse the Americas south to north by self-powered travel. You can find out more about them, of course, on their website, her-odyssey.org. They have currently completed 8,000 miles in South America of their 20,000-mile project and are now trying to forge ahead to the northernmost point. That is, until COVID and all the complications it has generated. In part one, we touched on the journey, but as it is one huge project, conversation naturally veered off as we discussed the land, the people, relationships, culture, and empowerment. In the second part of our conversation, I wanted to get below the surface and look at the impact an odyssey like this has on them personally. Plus, take a look of walking this financial tightrope they have to do. And of course, expectations of close family and the ones they set for themselves. Plus, of course, the good things and bad things they've learned about each other during this time. In my introduction, you will have heard me mention their individual trail names, Fidget and Neon. It is probably how they're best known or recognised in the US hiking, social media and blogging scene. A question I've always wanted to ask is, why do Americans have such fixation with finding, nurturing and owning a trail name? I can think of no other outdoor-related hobby or sport anywhere in the world where this features so heavily. Certainly, nicknames are commonplace. However, what's the big deal about a trail name and, in particular, the US hiking scene? Lauren, or should I say Neon, explains.
When I did the Appalachian Trail, which was my first long-distance trail in 2008, my understanding of it was that it was kind of a rite of passage. And most people I know from other countries who have done U.S. trails also have trail names. So I guess maybe it's just a U.S. thing. But part of my understanding of it was that not only is it a rite of passage, but then it's also like can be a safety thing. So like, yeah, you have the rite of passage and I'll like introduce myself as Neon. And then if people, I think these days it's a lot easier to find people on social media. But back then it was like, if you didn't know somebody's real name, like I didn't know most of the people, even the people I was hiking with's real name in 2008 until towards the end when we were like, okay, let's exchange information now. And so like to be like as a safety thing, there were a couple of times I ended up hiking with a lot of a mix of males and females. And there were a couple of times where one of my male friends, like there was kind of another shady person around, and one of my male friends didn't even want to go to the bathroom because he was concerned for me being alone with this other person. So that's kind of how I was introduced to it. And then the like recognizing it as both a safety thing, but also a, like, then it becomes like, oh, how'd you get your trail name? How'd you like, what silly thing did you do? And so then that's another way to get to know somebody better too. Like I had a friend on the Appalachian Trail who his trail name was Half Elvis. And like almost everybody knows who Elvis is and how he like would dance like with his leg out. And my friend did that going downhill because he had a bad knee, but he's only half Elvis because he could only do it with one of his knees. So it's like, that's my understanding of it. I do see it feel a big part of it when I got my trail name felt like community and identity. If I had to look at the roots of it, you know, probably the most recent is in our military. Oftentimes within the troops, those who are trained together or who are forged under fire give one another these names. And it creates that sense of community and of we were there together. And I see that happening even today on the trails, you know, people trying to pick each other out and what trail they've been on and what they have in common. And I can see in this specific regard that this has been an American style, but also in the American style of seeking an identity by mixing together the history of others. I mean, you can go way, way back in history and rites of passage and being given a name based on experiences that you have by the community that you're moving into and that name connotating that you have taken that step.
I mean, we definitely have nicknames. And which you sort of develop with people when they become close friends. But I noticed it seemed obvious when it was definitely out of place in a regular event that we have in the UK, which is a walk across Scotland, which is the TGO Challenge, and which is a sort of, you know, 300 or 400 people walking from the west to the east coast. And it's been going on for sort of 20, 30 years. And as part of the process, you bump into similar people on a regular basis at sort of all the hotspots, whether it be a town or on top of a mountain or whatever it may be. But when we've had groups of American come over, they insist on giving themselves trail names, which we all sort of turn and look at each other and go, okay. Why? My name's Bob. How do you do?
Yeah. Very fair. And I think that there is some part of that of wanting to emulate or wanting to be a part of something. And that does, I feel like if I ran into a group of people doing that, I would also probably, I wouldn't share my trail name with them.
I just wanted to ask that question because it's something that's been fascinating me for a long time. Now, talking about rites of passage, this is another thing now that's certainly with the progression of social media, there is now a lot of material out there about the AT, CDT, PCT, etc. I suppose when you look back in the distant annals, it was Bill Bryson's book that was the original social media. But beyond that, people would go and do the experience. But now it does seem to be there's a lot of blogs, videos, podcasts, social media, Instagram, or whatever else of people doing these various things. But it's the impression that the social media is giving something like the AT and the PCT and so on is that it seems to be a rite of passage for people that have left college or left school, so late teens, early 20s. And, you know, the name Trail Trash tends to get associated with them because the pictures suit the name. But it's not selling it as a, not that it should be selling it, but it's not endearing the impression that it is a tough hike or whatever. It's now become a well-trodden, serviced path or series of paths. That's how it's looking on social media. What would your comments be to that? Would you agree with that?
There are just so many people along the Appalachian Trail that you get into like clumps of, there is the party culture there even before social media existed there. I think now because of social media, it's kind of spread to other trails and it makes it more accessible to people who want to do that. People who, I did not see as many of those people finishing their through hike. So that I think is the big difference. It's like, yeah, you can go out and like we were joking about section hikers, but I think those are the people that are doing the partying and doing the are more sectioners. And then they'll be like, get to the Sierras and realize the Sierras are still under 2 to 4 feet of snow and be like, ooh, that's hard. never mind. Or they'll get to the San Juans and try to jump around and then be like, oh, this is hard. Like, it kind of, I think nature doesn't really give a crap if you have a Instagram account. It's going to do what it does, and to be aware and respectful of that. But it is a different culture. And I, like, honestly, I haven't thru-hiked a trail in the U.S. since 2013. So Fidget definitely has a different perspective. And it was interesting talking with her about having done the CDT last year after having not thru-hiked in the U.S. since 2013 as well. So, yeah.
From my perspective, I would say, to answer the first part of your question, I see hiker trash as a specific subset to a category that generally refer to ourselves as dirt bags, and that component of culture has arisen as sort of the new iteration of a counterculture to the, you need to be pursuing financial wealth in order to achieve personal fulfillment in life and seek stability over adventure. And I think that this is that movement is our generation's way of pushing back. And of course, within that, there's different factions, and we all have our assessments of one another. And in terms of the role of doing a thru hike, I feel like at this stage of what I saw when I was on the Continental Divide Trail as a 30 something woman, and a lot of people being like, whoa, you're old, or like, they'd be like, you did the PCT when? Wow, that was so long ago. Because they do it almost like a series. It's like you do the Appalachian Trail, and then the next year you do the Pacific Crest Trail, and then the next year do you do the Continental Divide Trail. And it's like the University of Dirt training. So it's almost like I feel like there's a chance to that through hiking has arisen in American culture in answer to the same thing as gap year fills for European young adults. It's a chance to go, to step outside of the normal bounds and to experience the world in a different way, and in a way which will hopefully inform you becoming a more engaged and informed individual and affect your overall life.
Mm. But does it work now? Is it different now to when you did it 10 years ago?
I think it's the same as it is with gap year kids and sort of what Lauren is talking about. It depends on what you go out there looking for. Mm. If you go out there looking for a party, you're going to find that. And your objective is going to be different than the people who are out there for the wilderness experience. Or, you know, there's people out there trying to hike off trauma or mental health journeys or finding themselves or shaking off, you know, whatever it is that you go out there looking for, you're going to find it because it really is just you out there. And so what needs will be met are completely predicated by what you bring.
So in your trip then on the CDT, did you meet many other old people like yourself?
I did. I really enjoyed that the Continental Divide Trail was more of a crosshair. There was a larger number than I think in years before of young, like 20-somethings, like mid-20-somethings. Not many. I think there was a couple 18-year-olds out there. And primarily probably later 20s, but a fair amount of us in our 30s. And then there was a good neighborhood of like 40 to 60 year olds, and then maybe a couple 70 year olds as well. But all of us approaching it in our different ways. Like the older folks who I met were more likely to be section hiking, versus the 20 year olds were there to do their through, and they were going to get it as fast as they could so that they could get that title of the triple crowner. And then they were going to apply for their medal. And, you know, they seemed to have them. They were the ones who were most offended when I wandered, because I would often wander off trail and go create my own route and then just reappear on the Continental Divide Trail. And they'd be like, where did you come from? And I'd always be like, no, same as I did in South America when people would ask. They'd be like, where did you come from? I'd be like, north of here. And they're like, well, how many miles did you do? Like, I don't know. I don't really count those things. That's not where my identity out here lies anymore.
You touched on something I definitely want to ask you, and it may be a bit personal, so forgive me if it is, but how do you balance the expectations that your parents have of you, of two 30-somethings ladies, versus the expectations you have of what you want out of life at this time of life?
So that's, again, we're just like so different people and we're raised very differently. And I remember the first time that Fidget and I were talking about like parental expectations, and I was just like, the only really expectation that I remember my parents ever having is that I like finish high school and like go to college and do something that I'm interested in and like then move on from there and like get a job and find a life that I enjoy. And so my parents' expectations have shifted over the years, I think, especially like after the Appalachian. My goal after that, doing the Appalachian Trail, was to, because I did it right out of college, like those gap year kids. And so I did it right out of college, and I fell actually into a group of 30-somethings. So I was really lucky for that. But then my goal after that was to go into hospitality and get a job with that. And so after I got off the Appalachian Trail, I was like, I'm still like not happy and I'm not interested in getting a job. And like, I kind of had that thought process in 2008, 2009. And then like I went and did the Pacific Crest Trail, and my parents were really worried because they were like, oh, there are bears out there, there's snow, there's like all this. And so they were really worried about that. And then when I went and did the Continental Divide Trail, I think at that point they had like adjusted and adapted and been like, okay, let me know when you're in town. And then when I went to do South America, it got to the point where they're just like, I do my best to like let them know when I'm in town so that they don't have to reach out to me. I can like reach out to them and be like, I'm still here and here's what's going on. And then they'll respond with like, oh, it's so good to hear from you. And so it just seems like my parents are, and I come from a family of four kids. So two parents, four kids. And I'm the third in line out of the four. So I think my parents are just like excited. My dad was a traveler when he was younger. So he like at one point we were having an email exchange and he was like, I'm just excited that I get to see where you are going. So just like, I do my best to like share photos with him and that kind of thing. And he's just like, oh, cool. I just like, you're in Ecuador. I just looked up this town in Ecuador that you're in and learned about it. So it's just really neat to have that experience and get to teach my folks differently.
Bethany?
For me, it was a similar path. It was, you know, the expectation to finish high school and then the expectation to finish college. And then where it took a significant pause for me was then my father in particular was like, well, and now you're going to go to graduate school and you're going to then get into the State Department. And then, and I realized that this person, out of an effort to love me, was prepared to lay out an entire life course according to a prescription that had been dictated to him. And when it became a matter of, and now you're going to fully bear the weight of the financial burden of this, I was like, I don't want that. I don't want to live a life of so much debt that I have to do something that I don't even know if I want to do to try to pay that off. So at the same time as I was finishing university, I took the evasive maneuvering of applying for a job on a glacier in Alaska with sled dogs where they literally could not get to me. And it was up there that I was able to save up enough money and that I heard about through hiking. And I did always know, like from when I studied at Oxford, I would just throw my books into my ruck and go hike for 4 or 5 days and read. And that was where I could best process the information. So I just kind of knew that the outdoors was where I could do my best and clearest thinking. So at that point, I made the intentional effort to have my life diverge from my parents' expectation. And the turnaround on that has been that right around the time of the beginning of this journey and through it, my parents have experienced a shift in their own lives of, wait, what are we doing? Let's try to do something different. They always very steadily followed the prescription of the church that we were in, and that you do this and then this and then this, and that's how you attain whatever life satisfaction you can, and then the eternal hereafter is going to be your reward. And their narrative began to shift while I was on this, and in that turn, a lot of their qualms about my lifestyle changed, and it became much more fundamental of, we want you to be well. And in that, carrying an InReach tracker where they can check in at any time, and within 10 minutes to 2 hours of where we are, they can know that we're moving, that we're well. They can see that I named campsite last night like camp cute puppy, and they know that I probably had a pretty good evening. And so having those available communications meets that basic want of knowing that we're well. And it has been a long and difficult process to relieve ourselves of some of those other expectations. But as soon as my sister gave my parents grandkids, a lot of that pressure also got relieved. So we did have I come from a sibling set of three, and we kind of had a sibling conversation. We're like, all right, somebody's going to have to like give some grandkids. And my sister's like, I'm totally into that. So we're like, awesome. So yeah, that's been the relationship with the parents. It's been shifting.
And always available. This is the Outdoor Station.
The impression that people might get listening to this is that you're leading, or have led for the last 4 or 5 years, you've been doing the Odyssey, quite a wild, footloose and fancy free existence. Handsomely paid by sponsors, driving top of the range four-wheel drives between your various locations, and I'm talking to you in a five-star hotel. You and I both know none of that is particularly true, but just to give people an honest idea of, I suppose sometimes I use the word sacrifices, as in the sense that you're not pursuing the traditional path you've just described of pursuing the career and getting the mortgage and buying the house and et cetera, et cetera. You've chosen this particular life. Would you describe it as a easy existence, or it's harder than you thought? And as part and parcel of that, because of the nature in which you've done the Odyssey Trek, so you've done it in seasons and then taken, I'm not saying time off, but you've taken breaks between seasons due to the weather or circumstances. Those sections of time, I'm assuming, must be really tough, because you're doing a lot of things. I'm guessing you are doing work for the sponsors. I mean, that would be another question. What do they expect from you? You're presumably trying to keep raising funds. You're presumably trying to keep awareness of what you're doing and sharing the message. There's the admin. There's your personal health, I guess, has got to be looked after. You've also got to have a bed to lie in somewhere. So for people that might think, hey, I want to be a traveler for the rest of my life, would you like to just share some honesty?
To the question of these in-between seasons, they are difficult because you're steeped in uncertainty. A friend, one of the co-creators of the Greater Patagonia Trail, put it quite astutely when he said, people think what you're doing is so fun and easy, but you're actually working three jobs and not getting paid for any of them. Of the maintenance of our website, and which is something that I love. Well, not maintenance of the website, but I love writing and I love sharing in the blogs and trying to communicate the value of those connections with people. That's the kind of currency that I think the fulfillment of my life deals in the currency of connection rather than of dollars. The dollar matter is also very real. And from another angle, if you look at me from the government point of view, I'm an unemployed, homeless person who doesn't even make enough money to be worth paying taxes. Like I just filled out the census and I was pretty bummed out afterwards because it's like, well, basically I'm just like a homeless, not contributing to the system. Like, and just this morning, and also I think there's another perception of like, well, you're doing this so it's to the complete disregard of your own future. It's like, no, like I just moved $100 to my retirement fund this morning, knowing full well exactly what that comes at of sacrifice to me for this next month. I mean, to be perfectly frank with you, like we're two adult women who in a time of COVID are homeless, and the wear and tear of that and the uncertainty and the inability to leave this country and to continue with our goal. So it's challenging in that component. And like my grandpa's dog ate my glasses and I can't, you know, they don't have
an address to send.
Yeah. Have an address to send them to. And I had to swallow my pride and, you know, my grandpa and his partner like handed me a couple $100 to help cover that because medical systems in the United States are not interested in, you know, I have Medicaid in the state of Colorado, but that doesn't translate to anywhere else in the country. And even within my own state, I have access to all of maybe three clinics. So there's a lot of, you know, medical, like we've both walked around with holes in our teeth with ongoing, you know, stomach issues. And it was easier in South America where you could walk into a clinic and get ciprofloxacin for 25 cents per pill versus in the U.S., when I was trying to preemptively see if we could get our hands on something and it would have been hundreds of dollars, or when I tried to figure out the consequences of if we got rabies, could we get the initials of the rabies vaccine? Could we get the first shot, which would buy us an extra 24 to 36 hours to get to a clinic if we got bit out in the middle of nowhere? And they're like, yeah, $10,000. So there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of tenuousness in your, it's just like what the entire journey is though, right? Like you're in an act of trust, you give yourself up and just know that what you need arises. I mean, between the two of us, our monthly income is at this point entirely from our Patreon and the rest of it is our personal savings. And we're living on about $700 a month, which would not be, as we're looking now, as we may have to like settle down for the winter because we can't get anywhere, that wouldn't even pay half of rent for one of us. Like,
wow.
And it's, we also have the privilege of choice and we have the people who support us. Like right now we're at a friend's house. When we are homeless, we are homeless and have a fallback. We have family and friends who love and care for us. And when we are struggling, there are people we can reach out to, like, especially like, even just talking about mental health, we have the ability to reach out to multiple friends who are trained therapists and they know and care and love us enough to be able to put down their time frame and help us out. We do struggle and we do have hardships, but there's so many other people out there who have it so much worse.
And so what about your sponsors then, and all the partners that I think you call them on your website? They've obviously helped you with equipment, but usually they don't generally tend to help much with finances. But what are they expecting in return from you? Is it just pictures, or do you find that when you come back and have these gaps between seasons, you have to spend a lot of time writing stories and blog posts or whatever it is for them?
Yeah, I think that ties back to your last question of what we lack in funds, the need, the vacuum of need that is created by that is filled by community and relationship. And largely what it seems that our partners and what has established the partnerships that have held for us over the years, like some of our partners are some of the first people who signed on with us, and every partner that we have, most of the partners that we have at this stage, the relationship has been for over a year. And it's more about that relationship and that checking in with one another. And so there is expectation of, we keep photo files, we reach out, we do some live conversations, we submit writing, social media content, video content, writing up reviews of the routes that we've been on, guides for other people. And then another piece of it, particularly in the current climate of COVID, is like some of our partners have had to withdraw their support. We had one financial partnership and she was giving us $75 a month, and she's a small, like, single owned business called Forever Karn, who does their best to responsibly produce goods, and she's just not able to sustain that, and she had to withdraw her support from us. But we're still going to do our part of that agreement of sharing her content, because we believe in the effort that she's making, and we believe in the community that we're trying to build by having these partnerships. So I think more than a matter of tit for tat, is it's, we stand a better chance of navigating this if we can work together and care for one another as people rather than as a business. Rather than seeing each other as a commodity, seeing each other as humans, which is why, you know, some of the larger potential for partnerships we have not pursued, because it just does not feel authentic. And that's one of the founding things, I think, it's why we stay and have ended up staying so poor and have such a relatively small following, is because we will always prioritize authenticity over ease or comfort.
Mm. Just a little insert here in the final edit. Bethany wrote to me afterwards and felt she wanted to add a little more to her previous comment. She writes, "You know, you asked about the challenges we faced, and I've never been invited to give air to that, and fear I went a bit ham with it. That said, I wished I'd finished by saying, and yet we're the lucky ones, because we may not have health coverage, but neither of us have chronic conditions. We may not earn enough to put anything aside or even really own much, but we're not in debt, and we're able to pay 10% of what comes in forward to other people and projects we believe in. To choose to live in a state of sacrifice and vulnerability is hard sometimes, and I find it deeply fulfilling. If this is the price we pay to live in freedom, I would choose it 1,000 times over again." So let's just lighten the mood a bit as we start to get to our last few minutes. Well, you met, what, 10 years ago, I think, roughly, 10, 12 years ago? Yeah, 10 years ago?
10 years ago.
10 years ago, okay. Okay, yeah. And you've been traveling on her Odyssey for 5 years? Okay, mm-hmm. Okay.
We started November of 2015.
Okay. So in that case then, as you're sitting next to each other, tell me the best thing about the other person, and then tell me the worst.
Ooh. Oh, man. I can only currently think of the best. And I think it's partially because, like, the worst thing only comes up at certain times. But I would say that the best thing about her is just how, like, when I came into this, I saw it as an adventure. And so I've, like, evolved with the journey, like, as we've evolved. Like, she said that she had this plan to travel and wanted to, like, stay on the course for as long as it took her to go from the southern tip of South America to the Arctic. And so as that has evolved, I too have evolved. I saw that coming into this, I saw it as an adventure, and I was like, oh, cool, an adventure. Like, I wanted to go do that. Like, that was my mindset at the time as a white person going to South America. And it has since evolved into, like, oh, what's going on? Like, kind of asking more questions about the cultural aspects, so about like the being able to see the intertwining of both the cultural aspects and the human aspects and the nature aspects and the wildness. And I've said this to her before, but I think I'd be on a completely different journey if I wasn't doing it with her. And so I would say that probably her best aspect is being able to interact with just about anybody and have like a truly genuine interaction, no matter where we are or what we're doing. So that's, I would say that that's probably it.
One of my 10 million favorite things about Neon, but really high up there, is her steadfastness. That we have this dynamic of I'll run through 100 ideas and she'll stay true to the course that has been set. And so being partnered with her has made me have to like change from like this like constant sense of like chaos and like the world is full of opportunity and also confusion, to having this anchor that helps me hold the focus. I think the worst thing about Neon is that in a stripped down environment, in the wilderness in particular, but also really anywhere at this point in our relationship, is that she holds up a mirror to my own worst attributes. And I have to, whereas I can think poorly and speak poorly to myself in my own head, and I won't ever question that. When I treat her like crap, I feel awful. And she's stolid and she'll just take it and it doesn't, you know, I'm from a very reactive family and she won't react for quite some time. I have to face my own worst tendencies because there's this partner by my side who is showing up for me in literally some of the worst times and in like most challenging environments and some of the most difficult times of my life. So, which is also, once you have a little bit of distance between yourself and that, a really cool thing, but when it's going on, man, it is something.
It's a difficult mire to make your way through when somebody else is pointing out your, I wouldn't call them flaws, but just like, kind of chinks in your system that you thought were working for you. And then all of a sudden they're like, well, maybe people think you're intimidating because you just like your intonation is really, and this is like feedback that I've gotten. I don't pay attention to my intonation. So that would be one of the more awareness pieces that I've learned over the years.
Like, we'll spend a long time arguing over what a word means. And it took us about 2 years to finally just be like, how about if we just stop doubling down and digging into our trenches on what this word means, and we just go to Google. So I'll like put it in my phone when we're out in the wilderness. And when we get to town, we go to a dictionary online and we like look it up and actually like learn what it means, rather than this like threat of like, well, if empathy means that to you and it means this to me, that means that one of us is wrong. Because there's the wonderful option that, you know, we might both be wrong, or in our own ways, we could both be right.
And we've had, I'd say, 25% of the time she's right, 25% of the time I'm right, 25% of the time we're both wrong, and then 25% of the time we're both right.
If you were to meet yourself now, about to start this journey, the Her Odyssey, what advice would you give yourselves at the start line?
I would say you've got this. Even in the moments when you think you don't, it will work out. Trust that.
would probably tell myself to let things go. And as we say in wilderness therapy, lean into the discomfort. And I like say that to a lot of other people at work, and then like having to do it myself is a completely different experience, it turns out. But yeah, it's like sometimes the best way to get through something is to lean into it.
Excellent. Well, look, ladies, it's been a marvelous and informative 2 hours conversation. It really has. And I'm sure there's lots of little topics. I've got all my questions here that I could have dipped into, but the topics we could have touched on, but I don't want to take any more of your time. If people want to know more about your journey and the stories behind the stories, there is plenty to read on your website, and all the details and the links are on the show notes, of course, which is her-odyssey.org, correct? Yeah. And as I say, the links to the show notes, and there's some pictures there and maps and things for people to look at as well. Now, if you have listened to my previous interviews, you will know the last question, which is going to be an interesting one, I think. Of all the things I could have asked you about her odyssey, your adventure for the last 5 years and where you're going next, what should I have asked you?
I really like the answers to these ones. The question that you should have asked, I lost it. Now I'm nervous.
I might have one.
Okay.
I think something that just because we are so, like our journey is very different than a lot of other people's in the way that we know the language and interact, because of like we come at things with more of a curiosity thing. So my thought is a question that you could have asked is who is like an impactful person that you met along the way and how did they impact you?
And what would you answer to that one? Actually, that's a good question.
We met this amazing woman in Vio Higgins. She knows exactly who I'm talking about. But again, it was a friend of a friend of a friend. This just spider web of people that we've met. And she was an artist, is an artist, in Vio Higgins. And she was the inspiration for our sticker series that we have. Over each season, we've done a different sticker, and they've all been created by different artists that we've met, or like your friend that we knew already, of the different areas. And so she was so impacted by our story. Her name's Marcella Stormison. And she was so impacted by our story that she decided to draw us. And she just like showed us this piece of paper that was probably like 4x6 of like, can I draw you? Can I paint this? And we're like, yes, but we want it. And she like wouldn't take money for it. And she just is. And so we like have since donated to her when we can for different endeavors that she's done with the local children. And, yeah, I would say that she was the most impactful. And I think she was the first person that I couldn't fully communicate with who I felt like understood where we were coming from. Because she led such a different life as well. And we actually have a Her Story about her that Fidget wrote up afterwards. Yeah.
And yourself, Bethany?
What can any given individual do to contribute the greatest positive influence on the earth?
All right, so you're going for a big one then.
Yeah.
And I'd say my answer is pursue what you're passionate about. Whether that's like in our Her Story series, like what Lauren is talking about, whether that's styling hair, whether that's painting a picture, whether that's advocacy, whether that's writing, whether that's exploration or climbing a mountain,
science
or math or whatever you're passionate about, the world. And whatever the doubts may be, go try. And the effects may not be what you think they're going to be, but they are going to be huge.
If you're fascinated by exploratory travel and deep, genuine associated experiences, then do look up Her Odyssey on their website, her-odyssey.org, where their ethos, passion, and genuine content is there for all to see. As you've heard, they are living on the financial edge, and Patreon is a great way to support any projects you believe in. So you'll find links to that and their social media on their website and, of course, on the outdoorsstation.co.uk show notes. My thanks to them for taking the time to talk, and it was good to touch base with two trailblazing travellers with genuine interest to look and to learn and to listen as they go. Not just outdoors people who hike solely to get pretty social media content. If you've enjoyed this, please leave a comment wherever you see it or drop me a line. A quick review on iTunes would be really nice too. So until next time, folks, take care out there and bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.